You are Locked On MLB, your daily podcast on Major League Baseball, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Hey, welcome to another edition of Locked On MLB, your daily podcast with news, analysis, opinions, and interviews across Major League Baseball to keep you informed on a daily basis. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network, local experts covering teams in every market across the NBA and NFL and our growing team here in Major League Baseball. We have another interview today. I'm excited to keep these going now that I'm a normal 27-year-old who learned how to use technology and record these things. Our guest today is Jason Rollison. He is our host and manager of Locked On Pirates. So we're going to talk about the surprising team in the National League Central, whether or not what they're doing is sustainable, and what might end up costing them. Before we get to that, we'll go through our daily rundown of what happened on Wednesday, each game, with some thoughts on each game. Segment two, though, is going to be on sort of a controversial topic. It seems that everybody's got a strong opinion on it, but I want to go over the specific unwritten rule of retaliation. We saw it twice on Wednesday between the Padres and Rockies, and then the Red Sox and Yankees. Is retaliation okay? How should it be done? What should happen to those participants involved? And why is there such a difference between a fan's opinion? I shouldn't say all fans, but one segment of fans' opinion and players who seem to all be in agreement that they like the way the game is, quote-unquote, policing itself. And so maybe that's something that when the Diamondbacks get back in town here in Arizona, I talk to some of those guys about, get their perspective, because you can't really get them on the record because you can't talk about intentionally hitting somebody with a baseball, because that Rob Manfred can't ignore. But if you just say that baseball got away from you, Rob Manfred can say, huh, it just got away. Now limit those mound visits. So that's what we'll go through today, and then segment three, of course, our interview with Jason Rollison on the Pirates. But first, let's go through our daily rundown here of scores across baseball. These are from Wednesday night. Wednesday, I should say, all day. Pull up scores here real quick. Atlanta, early on, blew two saves, but still pulled out a win over the Nationals, 5-3. Ozzie Albies, home run. Kurt Suzuki, two home runs. I think the big story coming out here is how long can Aroides Vizcaíno keep his closer role? A lot of people looked at A.J. Minter for that spot before, although Minter didn't come out quite as dominant as I think a lot of people expected. There are other questions about what moving Vizcaíno out of that role would do, because you know, in this game specifically, and I forget who I saw say this on Twitter, but it was a smart comment from somebody that I follow in the Braves community, suggesting, you know, what happens when you have the, you know, a Bryce Harper and a Matt Adams due up in the eighth, and A.J. Minter is your quote-unquote closer. Do you trust Brian Snitker to make that decision to move him into that eighth role? So moving Minter into the closer role out of that 7-8 role could take a valuable arm out of there. That's a really good point, but we'll see what happens there. The Astros came all the way back from down 8-1 to tie it in the ninth. 8-8, only to get walked off thanks to a Max Kepler home run, his second of the game. Fernando Rodney blew the save. I didn't watch it, but watching some of the comments on Twitter and seeing some of the stuff, it sounded like a couple, maybe a walk. He got a double play ball, but a bad throw by Dozier. Tough play anyway. So it wasn't quite a typical what you expect a Fernando Rodney blow up to be, but a blown save nonetheless. Something to keep an eye on with Addison Reed there in the middle innings. Max Kepler, a guy that I am not alone in thinking that he's going to have a big year. I think Brandon Warren has been driving that train for a while, our host of Locked On Twins, but two home runs for him, good to see. The Brewers, 3-2 over the Cardinals. Adam Wainwright pitched better, but I just saw a tweet scroll through my timeline that he threw 31 curveballs and didn't get a swing and miss on a single one. So that's not good. But Tommy Pham, home run for the Cardinals. Cardinals fall to 5-7. The White Sox, a late home run by Matt Davidson in the eighth, gives them a 2-1 win over the Rays. James Shields was really shaky early on, but it was kind of a controlled wildness, if you will. Like, he walked at least five guys when I was watching early. He was walked five in the first two innings, but I never felt like I wasn't missing by much. I never necessarily felt like the game was out of hand or he was about to lose it. So he was able to hold them in check. Mariners 4-2 over the Royals. I was watching that one for a while. Late Kyle Seager, two-run homer off Justin Grimm. Justin Grimm had been better. Small sample size, four innings for Kansas City since coming over from the Cubs. But Kyle Seager, the two-run homer off of him. Edwin Diaz, coming into the game, had 12 of the outs he recorded. 11 were by strikeout. He did give up a hit, gave up some contact, but nailed down his fourth save. Padres-Rockies, the story here isn't going to be the result. The Rockies winning 6-4 over the Padres. It'll be what we talk about later. Nolan Arenado hit by Luis Perdomo fastball, or actually threw it behind him. Nolan Arenado charges the mound, throws punches, said after the game he expects to be suspended, hopes it's not too long, but we'll get into that later. Set that scene. Eric Hosmer hit a home run, his first of the year. Although I think I saw somebody also on Twitter, and I do want to get better at citing these ideas because they're not mine or my stats that I found, but I think it was either Hosmer's fourth fly ball of the year or that was somebody being sarcastic, and it's kind of funny that I believe it if it really was his fourth home run or fourth fly ball of the year. Diamondbacks back on track, 7-3 over the Giants. Robbie Ray shaky again. He seemed kind of annoyed after the game. I was watching on TV, not in San Francisco, but in his post-game scrum, seemed kind of annoyed, and like he didn't want to talk about like anything was wrong, said he made one bad pitch to Buster Posey, who hit a two-run home run to tie the game. Velocity, I think it was around 94, but got out of a lot of jams early, wasn't able to get out of that final one, and that was a big story for Robbie Ray last year, where I think his strand rate was the best in baseball and a number that you don't necessarily expect to carry over. The other story here being Paul Goldschmidt hitting his second home run of the year. It looks like he's heating up, and as Bob Brenly said after the game, the rest of the National League is very worried seeing Paul Goldschmidt heat up. We'll see if that's true as Arizona heads to Los Angeles to take on the Dodgers. Indians 5-1. Over the Tigers. Scary moment there as Jordan Zimmermann took a line drive off the face. Jordan Zimmermann then with a good tweet saying he dodged a bullet, but not really, but he will be back in 5 days, so that is good to hear. Reds falling to the Phillies. A lot of weird managerial decisions here for the Reds. I think it was an extra innings or the ninth when there was the eight hitter up. I think it was Phil Gosselin was up for the Reds, and the pitcher was on deck, and Brian Price brought in Tucker Barnhart for Gosselin to bunt with guys on, I think it was first and second, to bunt him over to second and third, and then he just had to pinch hit for the pitcher spot anyway. So why not have, if you're going to bunt, why not have Gosselin do it and then bring in Tucker Barnhart to pinch hit, because you pinch ran for Devin Mesoraco, so you need to bring a catcher in the game. But that one was confusing. The Reds pounded out 11 hits, only 3 runs. I feel like that's what they did Tuesday too, though. A lot of hits but couldn't score runs. Phillies, home run from J.P. Crawford, Cesar Hernandez, Adubel Herrera, number 3 on SportsCenter Top 10. He robbed a 2-run homer in the 10th to keep him in it. Phillies moved to 6-5. Orioles moved to 5-8 with a 5-3 win over the Blue Jays. Kevin Gausman got his first win of the year. I watched that game for a little bit. Nothing really stood out necessarily, except for that both teams kind of wasted a lot of opportunities, especially the Orioles, but still came out on top. Mets were getting no hit for 7 innings by the Miami Marlins and then scored 4 runs in the 8th to beat the Mets. Or to beat the Marlins, I'm sorry. Mets now 10-1. You can listen to our podcast. Joe Nocco was my guest on Tuesday to talk about the Mets and their success so far. Yankees, I don't want to get into that scrum yet, as we'll get into that later. but the Yankees come out on top 10-7, move to 500. Gary Sanchez, two home runs. J.D. Martinez hit a grand slam. David Price left after the first inning, giving up four runs with something going on in his hand or left hand of some sort. I think they call it irritation. We'll see what happens there. Angels 7-2 over the Rangers. Elvis Andrus broke his elbow after getting hit by a pitch late. Cubs take down the Pirates 13-5. We'll talk more Pirates later. And the Athletics break through 16 runs against the Dodgers. The Dodgers are now 4-7 on the year. All right. So twice today, unwritten rules kicked in, and the specific unwritten rules of retaliation. Let's start with San Diego and Colorado, where Tuesday, Manny Margot was hitting the ribs, placed on the DL, and so early on, there was some retaliation, and then Austin Hedges gets hit. Trevor Story, I think, got hit first. Austin Hedges gets hit next, and then Perdomo throws behind Nolan Arenado, and Nolan Arenado charges the mound, throws punches, a bunch of ejections, and Nolan Arenado will probably be suspended. Perdomo will probably be suspended. And then the bigger story, just because of what it is, that being the Yankees and Red Sox and national TV on MLB Network, everybody watching, you had Tyler Austin slide into second base, and Brock Holt did not appreciate it. He slid in at about his ankle, I want to say, and spiked him a little bit on a hard slide at second. Wasn't to the side of the bag, wasn't over the bag. It was a normal slide that caught him on the ankle. Brock Holt then said something to Austin about it. The benches cleared. And the next time, nothing happened really there. The next time Austin comes up, Joe Kelly throws inside, misses him, then throws inside and hits him with 98. Tyler Austin slams his bat, charges the mound, and you've probably seen the highlight 1,000 times. So here's my issue with a couple things. One, it's not safe, and we've seen a couple instances where, you know, today, Elvis Andrus hit on the elbow by a pitch, breaks his elbow. Manny Margot on the 10-day DL after he gets hit in the ribs. And so it's not just this plan of, oh, I'm going to hit him on the butt cheek and he's going to have a bruise, and that's how it's going to work. Because pitchers are not that accurate. They don't know where it's going all the time, especially when they're aiming. So you never know. It could hit him in the head. But it doesn't have to necessarily hit him in the head for it to be a bad thing. It could hit him in the elbow, hit him in the ribs. Hip, whatever, you can hit him in a lot of places to hurt somebody. And that's not a, oh, that's a soft stance and you got to be tough. I mean, that's just stupid. And I feel like that's what a lot of players and some that I've even talked to, I think, you know, last year, the Braves were throwing at guys. I think it was the Blue Jays. The Blue Jays had hit a bunch of the Braves, and so then the Braves retaliated towards the Blue Jays early on, and I said that Julio Teheran should be suspended. And I heard from people saying, you know, relax, this is how it's done. And just because that's how it used to be done doesn't mean that that's how it has to be done now. Just because Keith Foulke and Pedro Martinez say, great job, that's how we're supposed to do it, that doesn't mean that that's how we do it now. And so not only is there the injury potential, but why do I want to give a team a free base runner? That's maybe the one that really I don't understand. If, you know, the Padres-Rockies was 6-4, that's a two-run game. I don't know if Arenado's run came across the score, but regardless, that's a free base runner. That's extra pitches that you're going to have to throw in the inning because you didn't get that guy out. In the Yankees game, 10-7, was the final there. I don't know, you know, whether that run scored or how that worked out, but still, I just don't understand the point of why do I want to give them a free base runner? In addition to the injury factor, why do I want to do that? And then some of the other issues that I have with it, and Evan Drellick out in Boston pointed this out. Boston did technically, or not technically, but did what the unwritten rule says you're supposed to do. When your guy gets attacked or you feel like they were attacked by that high slide, you get even. Okay, but now Christian Vasquez says, well, they're going to hit us next time we play them. So there's never an even, and it just keeps going and going and going. And that is just stupid to me. I just don't understand it. And again, I would love to have a conversation with a baseball player, a nuanced conversation where it's, just give me some context. Tell me what you're thinking, and then if I rebuttal and say, okay, well, isn't that, you know, why would I want to put a free base runner on if I could get somebody that's honest about it and say, yeah, that's a good point, you know, whatever. And there's tweets like a tweet from Rays prospect Brent Honeywell. I freaking heart baseball. I really, really do. Teammates, tough slides, brawls that people want to see, not a time clock and limited mound visits. They want ejections. They want homers, strikeouts, passion for the game. Good start, boys. I don't want a time clock necessarily. I don't want limited mound visits. It's entertaining for about 2 minutes to see a brawl. And then just as a baseball fan, I don't want ejections. I don't want my bench coach to have to finish a game. I don't want my starting pitcher out of the game. I don't want Nolan Arenado out of the game, whether I'm rooting for the Rockies or not. If I'm watching, you know, I don't want Nolan Arenado out of a baseball game. I want the best players to be playing. I don't want Nolan Arenado suspended. If I'm trying to see who's the best team in the league and the Rockies were a playoff team, I don't want Nolan Arenado suspended. I don't want Joe Kelly suspended. I don't want to play a game without the best players in it. So I don't understand where fans want ejections. What fans? The fans want to see the best players on the field, and so that's I don't get. I understand tough slides, and he came out and said dirty slides are different than tough slides, but who's to say, who's the judge on whether that was a dirty slide or not? Pretty much everybody that watched it said that's not a dirty slide. Everybody on the Boston Red Sox says it was dirty. Brock Holt says later, you know what, I should have just told him that wasn't right and then moved on. Yeah, that is probably how it should have been done. Hey, man, I didn't appreciate that slide. Now instead of throwing at you and then you throw at me and then we throw at you and then we have to think about it, like, I don't know. So I want to get a player standpoint on it, but that's my view. I just think it's dumb. I think it's bad for baseball. I think it's unfair, and I talked about this last year when Harper got hit by Strickland, and then Harper charged at him and threw his helmet. He missed, but I don't blame Bryce Harper. I don't blame the batter for doing something about it because the batters are the ones that are defenseless. They're the ones that are getting a baseball thrown at them 99, and if you don't think it hurts or not a big deal, check out the image going around from the dude that got hit by Aroldis Chapman on the ribs. It's like a crater on his torso. So, I just, from the baseball standpoint, from competitive standpoint, from a fan standpoint, from a suspension standpoint, Joe Kelly's going to get suspended for 4 games. He might have only pitched in 1 or 2 of them. Nolan Arenado gets suspended for 4 games. That's 4 days that he would have been in the lineup. So, it's just unfair from that standpoint. The pitcher's at the advantage. And so, maybe pitchers and hitters see it a different way. Maybe Boston felt like they had to do something because of how they handled it last year where they were split on what to do with Manny Machado. But either way, I just don't like what happened. All right, let's get to Jason Rolison, Locked On Pirates. We talked about their hot start. We talked about what is sustainable offensively, you know, starting pitching. We did talk about this before the Cubs ended up beating them that game, but we didn't really talk specifics on that game necessarily, so results there don't really matter. But, you know, is this winning streak sustainable? Is this early season stretch sustainable? What's going to cost them? And then we took a look at Andrew McCutchen and Gerrit Cole, that era of Pirates baseball and how fans look at them now. So here is Jason Rolison. All right, I'm now joined by Jason Rolison, our lead podcaster and manager of Locked On Pirates. One of the bigger surprises at the beginning of the season so far. Jason, what has surprised you or impressed you most about the team during this start?
Well, it's kind of abstract, but what's impressed me the most is just how loose the clubhouse is. John Parada, who's a great MLB reporter, formerly of FanRag, had in his newsletter today that he's talked to a few players off the record, and they are testifying to how loose the clubhouse is and how improved the atmosphere is. And you can kind of see it in their faces. These guys are having a lot of fun out there. Obviously, the last 2 years in Pittsburgh have been very trying for everybody. And you would think that with McCutchen and Cole, who you would think would be the leaders of this club having departed, that the clubhouse culture may take a hit, but these guys are really playing for each other and having a lot of fun. I think that's translating to the field. So kind of an abstract answer, but I think it all comes from that.
Is that more because of Cole? Is it McCutchen? Is it both? Is it expectations? I guess what was it about that clubhouse that's made things different and seemingly improved the overall attitude of the team?
Well, it could be something as simple as just having a fresh voice. I mean, I think, you know, I'm a very analytical guy when it comes to baseball, and it's one of the mysteries that you can't quite quantify, but it could be just something as simple as having a different voice or having guys who have maybe had it in them to be de facto leaders or maybe kind of lead the team on the field at the very least, now having a chance to do so. And when you think about it, you know, ever since Andrew McCutchen signed that contract, that great extension for the Pittsburgh Pirates to stick around, the clock started ticking. You know, they wanted to make sure he took advantage of the McCutchen era, quote-unquote. So I happen to think that now that he's gone, you know, the team is a little more free. I mean, there's not the weight of trying to cash in while McCutchen is in town. So I think that has to do the most with it. I think Gerrit Cole was just, you know, whether it be the Pirates' pitching philosophy or something else, you know, he was never going to quite reach the potential that he could reach here in Pittsburgh. So I think it's a combination of both, but if I had to pick one, I would say the departure of McCutchen might have the most to do with that.
Was the demise of the Pirates kind of a little overblown, maybe nationally? I mean, when I looked at getting rid of McCutchen and Cole, and it wasn't what Cole might do with the Astros, it was what Cole was doing with Pittsburgh, and I looked at it and said, he's good, but he's not like the most irreplaceable player ever. And maybe the same with McCutchen, where he was good, but you can find pieces that at least can plug in for somewhat of that value. So was the demise and this blow up and tanking, was that accurately portrayed or received by the nationally, or a little overblown?
It was a little overblown, and here's why. That demise was accelerated by starting Marte's suspension, Younghoe Kang's visa issues. So that right there, you're taking, you know, off the top of my head, at least seven WAR off the table from two players. That's going to put you behind the eight ball no matter what. And then you had the 2016 where McCutchen had a dismal year, bounced back a little bit in 17. So it's a case of anything that could happen or that could go wrong went wrong. So that case is kind of overblown. There was still a young group of talent here with Polanco and Jameson Taillon especially. And right now the club, with the additions that they got from the Cole trade, especially Colin Moran, Michael Feliz, the club right now is a good mix of young talent with some veterans in key spots. So I think it was always going to swing back that way. I really do. You got Marte back on the field now playing well. The club is solved. The third base situation with Colin Moran. So I always knew it was going to swing back the other way. So in that case, in that sense, it was definitely overblown.
How do fans look at the McCutchen, the Gerrit Cole era now? Is it too early to tell? Are they mad at him? Are they, we understand, we're over it? I guess what's the overall attitude towards those two now that they've moved on?
You know, it's curious. If you would have asked me this the day before the season started, I would say there's still a lot of resentment in the air, a lot of hurt feelings. Now, of course, getting off to an 8-2 start will fix a lot of that, and that'll be a solve for sure. But going back to that clubhouse thing, I think the fans are seeing that these guys are having fun. McCutchen sticking around for that last year was, it would have been, you know, gravy. It would have been the cherry on the top of the sundae. But I think now, you know, a week into the season, seeing that there's still some talent on this club, I think a lot of fans are still accepting. You know, you take a look at Pirates Twitter, and you'll still see those random RTs of something Kutch did, or that 6-for-6 night yet, or 6-for-7 night yet a couple days ago. You still see those retweets, but not as much as you would think, and that's just a byproduct of the team in Pittsburgh being more competitive than people thought.
And one of the things that I think, and obviously it depends on how McCutchen plays, but one of the things I bring up with the Cubs and Jake Arrieta is that I'm glad that Cubs fans don't have to go through that watching Arrieta decline, similarly to how I think Cardinals fans are looking at Adam Wainwright right now, where they don't remember that he was their best pitcher for a long time. They're looking at him like, get in the bullpen because we don't want to watch you start anymore. And so I think that's, whether we know it or not now, but I think that could be an added bonus of getting rid of McCutchen before that last year. Now, of course, if he goes out and hits 280 and 30 home runs and has a really good year, that won't happen. But got off to a little bit of a slow start, but started to heat up. So that's one of the things that I look at, too, that they're avoiding that possibility. So down the road, at least, Pirates fans can remember McCutchen as he was our best player.
Yeah, that's a good point by you. That's pretty fascinating, the way the kind of dynamic works. You know, distance heals all. You know, I think that applies for a lot of sports. So I think at the end of the day, you know, his legacy to the Pittsburgh fans is quite secure no matter what happens.
As I scout box scores, I admittedly haven't watched a ton of the Pirates, so it looks like the only thing that's not working for Pittsburgh right now is the bullpen. Is that fair to say?
Yep, absolutely. It's the biggest weak link right now for the Pirates.
And so what do they go about fixing that? Is it just guys that should perform better aren't performing? Is it you just don't have very good pieces in the bullpen? What's your assessment on that area?
It's very hard to get a grasp on because as they went about building the bullpen, the Pirates famously did not sign a major league free agent. We all heard the headline, but they did go about getting cheap, you know, minor league invitation to spring training deals for guys with a high strikeout ability. Left-handers like Josh Smoker and Jack Lodicich, who had K rates of something like 24-25% in that area. And they got Michael Feliz in the Cole trade, who is a very capable 7th or 8th inning reliever. They had George Contos coming back, and of course they had Felipe Vasquez, because he just changed his name. I almost called him Felipe Rivero. And I've backspaced so many times with that over the past 2 days. But the back end of the bullpen is pretty strong, but it's the front guys. You know, I mentioned that this is a team that tried to load up on strikeout ability for the bullpen, but their mid-inning guys, Edgar Santana and Davidas Navarauskas, the Lithuanian product in particular, are not quite ready to handle those mid-inning roles. So that part's in flux. And what happens is, you saw it yesterday when the Pirates got off to an 8-2 lead, but by the time it got to the ninth inning, it was 8-5, because the middle relief can give these runs right back. You know, you and I talked about that right before we started recording, the game that's going on right now. So I think they just have to find a better bridge to the back-end guys, Contos, Vasquez, and Feliz. If they can do that, they'd be fine. But it's still definitely a work in progress. But, you know, if the starters can keep going 6 innings of quality ball, maybe it's a little minimized right now.
Yeah, and I don't even mind that strategy, really. I mean, I think that's what the Arizona Diamondbacks did last year. They weren't sure exactly where they'd be, so why go spend money on bullpen arms? Instead, take, you know, get 6 or 7 or 8 flyers in spring training, see who's got some bullets left, and go for it. And that's what they did last year and got some solid pieces out of it at really no cost for the Pirates. If they get solid pieces out of it, great. If they don't, it doesn't cost them anything. And if they work out and they don't compete, that's a trade chip. So one of the things that we talked about a lot this spring was Tyler Glasnow and what was going to happen with him. You've been pounding the table to put him in the pen. It looks like he's in the pen. What's your assessment of him so far in that new role?
He's been taking strides. He really has. First maybe 2 appearances a year. Still shaky with his zone a little bit. But something clicked, and he's now a high strikeout and still a little higher than you like walk guy out of the bullpen. Clint Hurdle, the Pirates manager, has kind of said that he's not going to put Glasnow in any higher leverage roles rather than the mid-inning fireman guy. He's not going to put him in any higher leverage roles right away because he is just now getting used to the role that he's in now, which is that mid-inning fireman guy. And that's kind of the book on Glasnow. It's really all mental. I mean, there's no mechanical adjustment that he can do that he hasn't tried to make sure he gets over to the zone easier. So if he can build confidence and stay in that role, I think he'll gradually get more high-leverage spots. But the problem I have with Glasnow is that every single day that he's in that bullpen or every single appearance that he makes as a reliever, I believe the Pirates are taking one step closer to not being able to go back to him as a starter. I really fear about how this stuff plays over, 5-6 innings. He still has quite a limitation on a third pitch, being a changeup. He has his hammer curveball and all the fastball velocity you can want, but his four-seam plays a little flat. He's tried adding a two-seam with a little bit of sink, but it's a work in progress. So I think as good as he's playing in the bullpen, and he is, as good as he's pitching, he's still there to hide a little bit of his flaws. So I think they're right now they're just kind of saying, you know, okay, let's roll them out there and let them keep taking steps, because eventually we're going to have to come to an inflection point with this guy, and you only hope that when they get to that point that, you know, they have enough quality innings behind him to say, look, you can handle a starting role. So they're going to make a decision there, but it's going to be a little bit of ways away.
Is this a situation where they're not saying whether this is a permanent move or a temporary move? I mean, are they still saying that he can go back to being a starter?
Right before the season started, like when spring training was breaking up, yeah, that was the MO. And they were kind of definitely leaving the book open there. I can see a scenario where, you know, maybe a rash of injuries happened. Joe Musgrove is still having a hard time getting back from a shoulder strain. Maybe Stephen Brault, who's filling in at the fifth spot right now, isn't effective or injured, and they decide to give Glass another shot a little earlier than maybe they thought they wanted to. But other than that, yeah, the long-term goal is still, at least from Hurdle's mouth, is that it's still the ultimate goal to be a starter. So we'll have to see how that plays out during the season.
Kind of another Diamondbacks tie there with what they did with Archie Bradley and putting him in that swingman role. Originally they said, we're not using him in high leverage, we're going to keep him stretched out, and then he was just too good in that role that they couldn't move him back. But they've left the door open to returning, but he's so good in that multi-inning fireman setup, being able to close role, that I don't know if they'll move him out of there.
Yeah.
But with the on the offensive side of the ball, which of these individual performances do you think are sustainable, which is just a nice 10-game run or so?
Well, it's funny. Is can I say all of them? Because I really like the way that the club is set up in the lineup. I had real concerns with Colin Moran batting seventh. I thought that was a little bit of a waste of his skill set there. But what it does is it really makes this a pretty lengthy lineup when you think about it. You have Josh Harrison at the top, Polanco in the second hole, which has been working great. Then Marte and Josh Bell is coming into his own. Then you have Corey Dickerson, Cervelli, Moran, and then Mercer. Just to get serious about your question for a minute, I think Corey Dickerson has a chance to really have a big year. Where he's at in the lineup is really just perfect spot for him. Just go up there and try to make some things happen. He's already got five doubles on the year. Leads the National League in defensive runs saved somehow, so it's been great in left field as well. So I'm going to say he can keep it up. Obviously, he's got his chops, having made an All-Star team last year. And I really think that Polanco may be able to actually put a season together. You know, even in 2016 when he hit 25-some-odd home runs, I think 26 maybe, he was still a very stop-and-start kind of player, very streaky. So I think I go back to the clubhouse thing I mentioned at the top. He's having so much fun this year. It seems like a weight's been lifted off his shoulder, and he's a little more free and able to go out there and play his game. So there's a lot of exciting things to watch, with this Pirates lineup. I think it might all just be sustainable.
Is this a team that you can see being kind of like the Brewers of last season, where a little bit different circumstance, where the Pirates took away some talent in Cole and McCutchen versus the Brewers just maybe a year or two early? But are the Pirates your kind of surprise team now that, hey, they're going to be at least hanging around and not quite bottoming out, or is it obviously too early to tell?
Oh, yeah. I'm right there with you, because in our predictions for Lockdown Pirates, I predicted 84 and 78. I thought the team could steal a series here and there that maybe they shouldn't win. They're going to hit a slump. You know, let's be quite honest about it. I think, you know, every team does, and I think the Pirates will hit a slump in the middle of the season, or maybe even a little bit earlier. But if they can make some hay in the early part of the year, I think, you know, definitely a winning record is definitely in the cards, and I think being in contention until maybe 2 weeks out from the end of the season is a definite possibility. But the club talent level was there. Absolutely. I've never had any doubt of that. And getting three major league pieces for Gerrit Cole helps a lot in keeping that talent level up. So based on talent level alone, I thought they could win 82 games. So they may steal a series here and there, win a game or two they shouldn't, and end up with 85 wins.
Yeah, I'm looking at their schedule right now. They've got Cubs. They go to Miami. Then we got Rockies, Phillies, Tigers, Cardinals. I mean, you can keep this going. It seems like, you being the Pirates, the Pirates can keep this going if they four against the Phillies, those should be winnable, three against the Tigers. I mean, just take care of, like you said, take care of business and head into May with some of this momentum, whether you believe in that or not.
Yeah, and taking care of business early in the season has not been the Pirates' MO over the past couple of years, and they've always had to kind of claw their way, except for 2015, of course, the 98-win season. But otherwise, they've had a winning record the past 5 years. It's always been going on a hot run in the summer. So if they can reverse that, maybe get off to a better start, maybe it'll overcome any perceived shortcomings that they have.
We'll check it out, and we'll be following you at Locked On Pirates. So thanks a lot for taking the time, Jason. I appreciate it.
You got it. Thanks a lot. It's been very fun.